Hey, listeners, it's Watto here, and you're about to hear an unlocked episode from our Curbsiders Patreon, where we do twice monthly bonus episodes, where you can also get ad-free episodes. This is one of our bonus episodes. Paul and I on this one happen to be talking about IBS and dyspepsia, some disorders of the gut-brain axis or gut-brain interaction, based on one of our great episodes with Dr. Iris Wang. And I would like to say that on these episodes, they are shorter. These are really meant for space learning, both for us and for you as the listeners. So if you don't like the longer episodes, you might like these because they're about 30 minutes or so. At the end of the episodes, we take listener questions. On this episode, we happen to talk a little bit about fatigue and how Paul and I approach that. And then we end the episodes with some fun picks of the week. We think you'll really enjoy it. We've already released 32 of these bonus episodes on very high yield topics. So check all this out and sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like Moral Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
That was a real like Stewart delivery right there with the hi, Paul.
Yeah, no, it didn't feel super sincere, but that's okay.
Okay, so Paul, this was episode number 334, IBS and functional dyspepsia. We also talked about cyclic vomiting with our great friend, Dr. Xiaojing Iris Wang, and of course, production by the great Dr. Elena Gibson, who is, going to be a GI wonderkind very shortly, you know. But Paul, let's start off with what exactly are these functional GI? Well, we used to call them functional GI disorders. What are we calling them now?
But I guess disorders of gut-brain interaction. I thought they were disorders of the gut-brain axis at one point. So I think the terminology is still evolving. But the point, taking functional out of it, because that assumes that there's no actual pathology there, which is not 100% correct. It's that our testing has not caught up with what the pathology actually is. So there's lots of reasons for patients to have discomfort. We just don't have great tests for it.
Right. So Dr. Wang actually tells people, I expect your testing to be negative in these conditions. And I thought part of the interesting thing and how she counsels patients is she says, listen, the gut and the brain embryologically, their nervous systems develop together. And when they separated, you know, there's still that link. And that's why part of how we treat this condition is with neuromodulators. And as you said, Paul, we don't have great tests for this, but we do tell patients, listen, I think this is what you have. I'm going to order this testing, but I expect it's going to be negative. And when it is negative, that's okay because we do have treatments that we can offer you. And I think just, you know, laying that out up front can hopefully help the patient cope with the diagnosis and understand what's going on a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, so much of her episodes, first of all, she's incredible. Like it's every time I re-listen, I'm like, man, she's good. But she, and I don't want to misspeak here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think she describes it because I just love her framing and how she, her sort of illness scripts for patients, how she talks to them. She talks about like your gut has pulled the fire alarm. And so we're going to go, we're going to investigate, we're going to make sure that there's no fire, but your body's signaling that there's something wrong here. And once we check out that there's no fire, that doesn't mean there's nothing wrong. It just means we have to investigate someplace else. So like she really frames it as in validating patient symptoms. And, you know, this is not anxiety. This is not nothing. It just means that our tests aren't good enough to detect what's going on and we can make sure that it's not going to kill you first.
Yeah. So let's get into functional dyspepsia first, which, you know, there's two flavors of it. There's the postprandial distress syndrome and there's epigastric pain syndrome. And they pretty much are what they sound like. There's some time criteria for it, Paul. Like it has to occur at least weekly over the course of 3 months, and your symptoms have to have started at least 6 months ago. But honestly, that's helpful for research. But in real clinical practice, like if you think someone has it and it hasn't been a full 6 months, like you're just going to diagnose them.
Yeah, right. I think it's the IBS specifically where the guidelines are changing to give you less lead time, so patients aren't waiting 6 months for therapy. They may actually sort of shorten sort of the criteria at some point, I think.
So with functional dyspepsia, the postprandial distress syndrome, she just mentioned that there's this issue with early satiation where the stomach just feels full even after a small amount of food. And that's probably because it can't stretch to accommodate the food bolus. And that's part of what you're dealing with, as opposed to something like early satiety that you get with gastroparesis, where the person eats a meal and the food just doesn't move through and it's just kind of sitting there in the stomach and they feel full for a really long time. And that's because of a transit issue. This is more of an accommodation issue. So she said they do have overlapping symptoms between gastroparesis and the postprandial distress syndrome, which I thought was a cool thing. I didn't know the difference between the satiation and the early satiety.
No, I don't think I'd heard the word satiation before she said it out loud during that episode. So that was helpful, I think.
So, Paul, what kind of workup are we going to do for functional dyspepsia, whether someone has postprandial distress or epigastric pain syndrome? It's the same workup. What are we going to do?
Yeah, so you start out by testing for H. pylori. That's part of the guidelines. I think we talked about this even in an episode before we talked to Dr. Wang. But you test for H. pylori, you treat the H. pylori. It is the evidence is not super strong that once you treat the H. pylori, the symptoms will get better, but it's still a good thing to treat. So you should do that. And then the initial treatment, which may be lately diagnostic, is treating with an effective dose of a PPI for at least 4 weeks. Alternately, you can consider an H2 blocker. And it's interesting. I do have a number of patients who are really worried about PPIs. I think that has reached sort of the layperson that PPIs have potential side effects, even though they are very safe medications overall. But it turns out that H2 receptor antagonists may also decrease hypersensitivity. So much of this is probably visceral hypersensitivity, which we'll get into. And just you're sensing things in the gut that you're just not supposed to sense. And that is transmitted to your brain as discomfort ultimately. So a lot of the treatments that we'll talk about are about decreasing that hypersensitivity just so that you're not noticing things that you're not supposed to be noticing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other things, just pathophysiologically for all the disorders of the gut-brain interaction, she gave us like a whole list of them. And it Paul, they kind of sound like gobbledygook to me because it's just like, you're just throwing out terms. It's like being like, oh yeah, it's like cytokines. And I'm not making fun of it. It's just like the pathophysiology, altered motility, visceral hypersensitivity, epithelial barrier changes, mucosal immune dysfunction, microbiome disturbance. So basically, you know, just like all sorts of things are going wrong with the gut. Everything's out of balance. And, you know, mainly the treatments that we talk about are treating the visceral hypersensitivity portion of it. But they think there's more than just that going on. So some of the general things that she said you can do are just like easy stuff to tell people in primary care, like make sure you're not taking a bunch of NSAIDs and smoking and drinking alcohol, because those are all irritants to the stomach. Okay, so that's easy. And then since they feel this early satiation and their stomach can't accommodate, they'll probably do better eating smaller, more frequent meals than they would eating large meals. What about like peppermint oil, caraway? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so for the patients that are hesitant to take medications, there are certain patients that might be more amenable to sort of more naturopathic feeling approaches. And it turns out that we do have some things that might be helpful. So peppermint oil can be helpful. And this, by the way, should be the pharmaceutical grade. There are certain formulations of it because it's actually, if I remember correctly, it's supposed to be enteric coated. So it's not released in the stomach itself. Like it's supposed to make it to the bowel. So it should be pharmaceutical grade and not the essential oil that you would put into a diffuser, because that is poison. So don't take that. And then I guess you can, I think this is so foul sounding to me, but I should not poison the well, I suppose, but you can brew caraway seeds into like a tea. So if you want tea that tastes like something that needs corned beef, that is certainly an option. And then I think there's some formulations, I think, Matt, that you shared with me that have like a combination of caraway extract and then also menthol, I want to say, that is also available for folks too.
Yes, there's two different ones. There's one, these are brand names, but this isn't a CME activity, so that's okay. So IB Guard is peppermint oil. That's for the IBS formulation that's sold. And then there's FD Guard for functional dyspepsia, and that's caraway oil and L-menthol. You can buy those online. I tell patients it's okay to try it. It's a little bit expensive if they were going to buy it and take it, you know, every day around the clock, but it's available. They can order it online at your online retailers. So it's something that's an option for them. And you know, there are medications as well. So if that doesn't work, you know, the simple stuff that we just talked about doesn't work. You treat their H. pylori, they do a PPI trial, they do the lifestyle stuff and some of the supplements we just talked about. There's neuromodulators. So buspirone for the postprandial distress syndrome. And the reason for that, she said, I'm not using it to treat anxiety. I'm using this because it has some smooth muscle relaxation properties. Remember, these are the people with the problems with accommodation in the stomach. And she uses a dose of up to 15 milligrams three times a day with a meal and says she's had some luck with that.
Importantly, you wouldn't start with 15 three times a day. Just put it that loud because your patients will not be able to stand up. So I think that's you probably start like 5 milligrams at nighttime and sort of see how they do by increasing the dose from there.
Yeah. So titrate that up slowly. And same thing with the other medications. So you can use TCAs, of course. Like any chronic painful condition, Paul, TCAs generally seem to work. So TCAs you can use. She prefers, instead of amitriptyline, which is an older generation, she prefers nortriptyline or disipramine, and kind of doses those, and they can be used to treat either the epigastric pain syndrome or postprandial distress syndrome. Now, Paul, do all these patients need an EGD?
So no, and this goes back to her, Dr. Wang, framing this as a positive diagnosis. A lot of the times, like, you have a very good sense of what's going on here. So you talk about, you know, you don't expect a lot of the testing to come back as positive because, again, our testing is not good. And EGD is not required because for everyone, because if you have someone who does not have red flags, who is young, who does not have risk factors for scarier stuff, and they respond to therapy, you can be done. Like, you can say, okay, I know what this is. They responded appropriately and we've figured things out. If they have risk factors for scarier stuff being like, say, oh, I don't know, esophageal malignancy, say they're over the age of 60, or they have a heavy tobacco history or any other reason to sort of suspect something a little bit more sinister, then clearly EGD would be part of the initial workup. And you might also consider it if you have someone who has not responded to the appropriate therapies, you think you know what's going on, you treat them appropriately, nothing changes, that person probably warrants a little bit more evaluation, even though realistically, a lot of these patients will get EGDs pretty early on in the course of their workup.
Okay, let's move on to IBS, which IBS, I think most people, even most lay people, have some sense of this condition, but this is another one of the disorders of gut-brain. And it's recurrent abdominal pain. Usually there's a change in stool form or frequency, and their discomfort is often relieved by having a bowel movement. Again, we already talked about how this doesn't necessarily need to be present for 6 months, but that's not the most important part of it. Paul, as far as like the testing for this, now we've had some algorithms from previous episodes, but tell us a little bit about what testing you would do if someone had IBS, like with diarrhea predominance.
Yeah, the good news is, you know, when we talked to Dr. Wang, a lot of the work that she does initially is stuff that I think most people in primary care would be comfortable doing. So I think, you know, if someone initially comes to you with diarrhea, you would probably, I would at least hope, think of thyroid testing to make sure you're not missing hyperthyroidism. You would look at their medication list to make sure there's nothing particularly irritating, especially now that everyone is on a GLP-1 agent. I think that's probably a good thing to look at and sort of figure out the timing of that. You would make sure that they don't have risk for malabsorption, no surgical history that would sort of set them up for having increased diarrhea. Like, you know, do the detective work that, you know, you said on your med school applications, the stuff that you enjoy getting into medicine for. You probably would worth checking for celiac disease in the right patients. And you could even check the fecal calprotectin, which is a way to look for the inflammatory bowel diseases, and CRP, similarly, sort of indirect evidence of that. If you have someone who has, if they've gone camping or they're drinking river water for some reason, you can check Giardia. You know, if they've had antibiotic exposure or healthcare exposure, certainly you can consider C. diff testing if the pattern fits, and there is community acquired C. diff as well. But really, I think that's stuff that we all kind of think about and know how to manage. We've all dealt with initial diarrhea. And then barring all that, if that testing is negative, it's probably reasonable to start thinking about IBSD as a potential diagnosis.
And we have a figure that we'll leave in the show notes for this one, with that Elena Gibson made. And, you know, on the osmotic side of the chronic diarrhea workup, you really think about, like, are they surreptitiously taking laxatives, which I think would be a rare cause, but more you got to ask about lactose intolerance and maybe something that they're eating is causing it. So if their diarrhea doesn't happen when they're fasting, then maybe, you know, maybe then it is something that's osmotic. So check out that figure because it's a really great figure to go through. On the constipation side, another great algorithm that Aleda Gibson made, you know, talking about constipation. So first, you just want to make sure you're not missing a secondary cause. Like, make sure if there's any kind of red flags that make you think it's a cancer, then of course, go after that. Or if they're due for colon cancer screening, then, you know, they should have the colon cancer screening. But you don't need to do a colonoscopy for every patient with constipation, really, not unless there's red flags. So make sure their medication list is okay. Again, don't miss the thyroid disorder, like Paul said. But a laxative trial for most patients with constipation is a reasonable way to go. And Dr. Wang also asks about this dyssynergistic defecation, Paul. It's hard to say, but essentially...
You did great.
Essentially, it's where the muscles on the floor of the pelvis are just, you know, contracting when they're not supposed to be, or not relaxing when they're supposed to be relaxing. And part of the way you can get that history, she said, is people are doing toilet yoga, or if people are having like rock back and forth, if people have this sensation of incomplete emptying, a lot of the times she will recommend they get one of those stools, like a squatty potty that goes at the, to put them in a better position to fully evacuate. And in some cases, she's even sending patients to pelvic therapy for that. But barring any issues, a lot of patients can do fine on just like your simple laxatives, Milk-O-Mag, polyethylene glycol. Any other favorites?
I feel duty-bound to say she feels really strongly about doing the digital rectal examination of patients with chronic constipation. I think,
yeah.
I'm not sure if you've progressed to that with your standard workup, Matt, but I know that's something that Dr. Wang feels strongly about.
Yeah.
Just, again, checking for that dyssynergy.
I know. Maybe in the right patient, Paul.
I'm not trying to call you out here, buddy. I just
not my favorite exam to do, but yes, you're right. Okay, so let's talk about the treatments here, some of the treatments she recommended. I just want to mention up front, there's something called gut-directed CBT, there's gut-directed hypnotherapy, and both have a number needed to treat as low as 4. They're hard to access. Iris, the Dr. Wang, actually happens to be a gut-directed hypnotherapist, but if you're lucky enough to be in a big city, you might have someone there that does that, and that can help. And hopefully in the future, we'll have online resources for that. But Paul, let's say someone has IBS with diarrhea. What about this FODMAP diet? Stay on it forever? ?
Yeah, I don't know what practice you've seen, Matt. I've seen folks like print out the FODMAPs foods from Dr. UpToDate, whom I trust in all things, give it to the patient and be like, just avoid these until you die. And that's probably not the best approach for a couple of reasons. And in part, it's if you've seen the list of foods, it is extensive. Like it's a very restrictive diet. And for that reason, you really shouldn't be restricting it for any longer than 6 weeks before you start reintroducing those foods back into the diet to see sort of what you tolerate and what you don't. In part because it's otherwise would be miserable, but also because you are running the risk for micronutrient deficiencies. And also you can create food intolerance if you restrict diets for that long. So it's really important that if you're going to do the FODMAPs trial to start reintroducing foods after 6 weeks and not just parking patients. Probably luckily most patients don't tolerate it for that long or kind of give up earlier than that. But still, you should just be very proactive in your counseling about that because you could actually cause harm with it.
Yeah, it, since the first time we talked to her about this, which was years ago at this point, I've been really making sure people know it's not a permanent diet. So that's definitely one thing that a lot of patients, especially with the diarrhea, bloating, you know, I definitely prescribe it for them. For people with, and also for people with diarrhea, she mentioned that when they're having a flare and they're having bad diarrhea, just tell them to schedule loperamide until they get better, rather than just trying to take a dose as needed, like after they have episodes of diarrhea, which is the way it says to take it on the bottle, because that just doesn't work for these folks.
Yeah.
For the constipation type, Paul, we mentioned Milk-O-Mag, we mentioned polyethylene glycol. They can do Senna, they can do Ducalax, but what if those aren't working? What do people generally reach for?
Yeah, you can escalate to the less over-the-countery varieties of medications. So there's the lubiprostone and the linaclotide, which are, you don't necessarily have to be a gastroenterologist to prescribe. They're reasonably safe medications in the right hands. And those would be probably the next step in management if they're not responding to this or the standard mm-hmm. issue stuff that I think we all have a fair amount of comfort with.
Yeah, and you know, peppermint oil can be used here too. Just the caveat, again, don't, if they have really bad GERD, don't be using peppermint oil. And if for global symptoms, peppermint oil seems to have some effect. Also, TCAs are a good choice. And again, you would use the same, like the newer generation, nortriptyline, disipramine for that, and kind of start low, go slow with those. If someone has the constipation type, you just want to be careful they're not getting overly constipated from the TCAs that you're starting. So you got to warn them that that's a potential side effect. The antispasmodics, she said they're okay for cramping, but not so much for global symptoms. So, you know, they don't have a huge role, but I do see a lot of patients get prescribed them. And I just generally tell patients, like, don't take it if it doesn't help, but it's, you know, it's okay to try it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like that's one of those medications that once it ends up on medication list, it's there in perpetuity because no one remembers who added it. So you just assume they need it forever. And it's if it's not doing anything, just take it off.
Yeah. So we also talked on this episode about cyclic vomiting and cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. But Paul, I think we need to move on because we have some listener questions to answer. And this will just end up being way longer. And these are supposed to be shorter episodes. So let's go to our first question. This is from Evan Bergman, he's asking, is the Discord app more active than the Patreon for medical discussions? So, Paul, you want to take that one?
Evan, friend, you've embarrassed me because I did not know that there were discussions happening on Patreon. So I have to assume the Discord is more active than Patreon. So there's a really active community there, sort of running cases past each other. In general, I don't think we're giving specific medical advice, but sort of just talking about what our treatment experiences have been and kind of talking about our issues with specific medical concerns. So it's a blast to watch. I don't get involved as much as I would like, but there's a really vibrant discussion happening over there.
Yes. And that's the way it's intended. That's what we have the Discord for. The Patreon app is really just for us to like alert people and send out general communications. But if you want the really quick back and forth and robust discussions, you got to be on the Discord. That's where that kind of thing is happening. All right. And then next question is from Jennifer Driscoll. She says, very broad question, fatigue. Patients, you know, coming in saying they're so tired all the time. They have normal lab work, no sleep apnea. What's your next step? What do you say to them? And, you know, anything else? We did do a podcast episode on this, by the way, with Dr. Nina Mingioni years ago, which was fantastic. But Paul, what's your approach to this?
It's actually, this is a nice episode to have this discussion with because it's one of those things where you want to validate symptoms, but also not go down sort of the spiraling trial of diagnostics so that you end up with more stuff than you know what to do with. So I think this is avoid the temptation to just do sort of blanket, you know, Lyme serologies and that kind of thing. So I do think fatigue is a really important and really debilitating symptom. And especially since the COVID pandemic, now we've got one more big thing on the differential to kind of think about as a potential etiology for it. So I keep that one in my back pocket to sort of think about, but I do think fatigue often is a great chance to just kind of discuss life stressors. And I know this will not be deeply satisfying probably, Jennifer, but I do use this as a chance to kind of rescreen for depression and just sort of reassess just how things are going in general. I you know, it's oftentimes you're not going to find an organic cause for it necessarily. The lab work will come back relatively bland. And I think if you look too hard, you're going to find stuff you don't know what to do with. So it's a chance just, I think, to actually get to know your patients a little bit better, find out what's going on with them in their personal lives, and if there's anything, any other stressors or anything else you can sort of help mitigate. So I don't have a very fancy or pathophysiologically satisfying approach to it, but more a psychosocial, you know, how are things really, once I've done the sleep apnea and the, you know, the thyroid testing is sort of the bread and butter stuff. I don't know, Matt, what do you do differently? I'm sure you have a very smart algorithm for it.
I think in general, for any kind of chronic nonspecific condition, I just tell people, like, listen, we've done your labs, the CBC, CMP, thyroid study, maybe any other things that might be pertinent to the patient. But I usually don't do a ton of labs. And I just say, like, in general, we need to make sure you're sleeping. Okay. So we need to optimize that. If that's not optimized, you know, that is a big pillar of you having enough energy. We need to have you moving. So, you know, what's your activity level like? What's your, you know, are you doing any physical activity as much as you can tolerate? What's your eating like? Are you eating just hot garbage all the time, as you would say, Paul? Because, you know, that's gonna take away from your energy. And then if there's stress, if there's a mood disorder that's unaddressed, like, that can suck all your energy as well. So we need to make sure those pillars are there. And if they're not, let's address those and see how you feel. But, you know, I'm not like full body CAT scanning these people. I'm not sending off I'm not sending Lyme on every single patient that's coming in like this. I think in the right patient, you can do, but I think digging into the history a little more too, did they have like a terrible illness where they were in the ICU for a couple months earlier that year and they've never just recovered to their same level? You know, sometimes you'll find that kind of thing.
Great chance to go through the meds again too. You know what I mean? Like there's plenty of stuff that can just be energy set. You know, if you have someone on a chronic beta blocker, that kind of stuff, you won't necessarily stop it, but it's a good chance to kind of just rethink critically all the basic fundamental things that maybe you've taken for granted for the patient, which it's easy, I think, to do and kind of have things on autopilot. So I think fatigue is actually a nice opportunity to go back and sort of do fundamental reassessments.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's no easy answers. I know patients want it to be hormones so they can, you know, there's some hormone that you're just going to replace and they're going to magically feel 100% better, or some micronutrient deficiency or something. But, you know, that's usually just not the case. So,
yeah.
But I usually work with them to try anything that seems reasonable that's not going to harm them in some way. And the second part of this question, Paul, was talking about the fibromyalgia episode and just asking, like, what are our go-to medications for fibromyalgia? Do you have a preference for TCAs or duloxetine, you know, SNRIs? What do you think, Paul?
I personally, based more on side effect profile, probably lean a little bit more heavily on the SNRIs than I do the TCAs. I do think in general, the trainees that I see are actually scared of TCAs, which I think are good medications, as we've talked about in this episode already. I think there's a lot of compelling reasons to use them. But for fibromyalgia specifically, I like the SNRIs because there often is concomitant mood stuff. And I think the TCAs can be a little bit sedating, which is not necessarily what you want for these patients who feel kind of foggy and fuzzy already. Mm-hmm. So I like the SNRIs a little bit better. But I tend to not frame this as the medications are going to be the thing that sort of fixes the symptoms. I really do think sort of remaining physically active and you know, I direct folks towards the fibro guide still to kind of manage their specific symptoms, because I do think a lot of this is going to be behavioral and lifestyle changes, more so than medications. The medications, no one's ever really, you know, came back and said, I'm different now because of the gabapentin that you started. So I think you're sort of, the lifestyle modifications seem to have the biggest bang for your buck as far as I can tell.
Yeah. And the any non-pharmacologic therapies is what I really lean on for this. Patient education, trying to get non-pharmacologic therapy in there. And the same kind of pillars I was talking about for fatigue are what I try to help them focus on, because there was a meta-analysis looking at all the medications. I don't know if it was 2022 or 2023, but most of the medications don't work. And if they did work, if they had a significant like p-value, they're clinically, it's unlikely that they have a big effect. And that was the conclusion there. So the medications are not what's going to get this patient better in the long run. You can try them as part of your therapy. But I even tell patients, I'm like, medications are like, I don't even know if they're a pillar for this, but they're something we can try. But we got to do these other things too, the sleep, the lifestyle stuff, the mood and managing your mood, your stress, your anxiety, that stuff.
Yeah,
you got to work
really
on.
Really well said.
So, Paul, time for some picks of the week. And Paul, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I don't think I've recommended this one before. I think we've talked about it, but I have finished the first season of Yellow Jackets and I've started the second season. So Yellow Jackets, in case you all don't know, like, I feel like it's gotten a fair amount of traction. It has been up for some awards, but it started in 2021. It's about this girls' soccer team in the late 90s, which are my formative years, are in a plane crash and are sort of abandoned in the forest and left to fend for themselves and are sort of starving through the winter, and things go horribly awry. And then there's a parallel timeline that happens the present day about sort of what the survivors are dealing with and sort of how this has impacted them and sort of how it's infecting their lives. So it's beautifully cast because you have these younger and sort of modern day versions of the same characters, and the casting is incredible. It is, I think, really smartly deals with what relationships among young adults look like. I thought it actually was fairly realistic about what late adolescence, early adulthood actually looks like, even though it's set in sort of this horrific circumstances. It is a horror show. Horrible things happen, by the way. I should caveat this. And then because so much of it is set in the 90s, the soundtrack is just chef's kiss, outstanding. And the opening credits, Matt, have you watched the show? Do you like Yellow Jackets?
No, it looked too intense for me. And I could probably deal with it, but my wife would not watch it with me.
Yeah, I think you'd have to find some you time. Maybe when some of this upcoming travel conferences, maybe you'll get a chance to see it. But the opening theme song is co-written by Craig Wedren, who is he was in Shuddered, I think, a former pick of the week for me. And he's also written stuff for like The State and The Whitest Kids You Know. So it's this incredible opening soundtrack to the show as well. So the score is fantastic. The show is beautifully acted. It's really compelling. It is gnarly and hair raising. So and harrowing. So if you like that kind of thing, you haven't seen it yet, I would encourage you to check out Yellow Jackets.
My pick is going to be a book, and it's called A Guide to the Good Life. This is written by William Irvine, and I definitely recommended it, but it probably about 8 years ago, Paul. This is the Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, and it's a small book. It's a short book, very practical. It probably, you know, when you're talking about like, this is a book on philosophy, but it's very readable. Like he makes it readable and practical. And these are just like good tips, like just like, you should imagine losing things that you have because that way you will enjoy them more that you still have them. And if you do end up losing them, you will be emotionally more prepared for it. You know, that's just like one tip that's in this book. And that's part of the Stoic philosophy, which is an ancient philosophy. It's a really good book.
The Stoics always seem so smug to me.
I seem so smug to you?
No. You never seem smug. But the Stoics in general, if you ever heard someone like who just calls himself a Stoic talk, they just seem really proud of themselves. And I just kind of want to punch them.
Yeah. But this book, I certainly don't call myself a Stoic, but this book I think is just a good book just to help, you know, recenter yourself. If you're, I don't know, if you feel like reading some philosophy that can be practically applied to your life, then I think this book is a really good one. And, I've read it a couple times now and I'm going through it again, you know, every couple of years. So that's it. Well, Paul, I think we've done great work and we should probably get to an outro.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox, which includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we want your feedback. So please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. It really does help other people find the show. I want to give a special thanks to all of you, all of our patrons, for your wonderful support that helps us keep doing this show. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.